I murdered my father at a very early period of my life. I have since murdered my mother, and I am now going to murder my sister. I have changed my religion so often that at present I have not an idea of any left. I have been a perjured witness in every public trial for these last 12 years, and I have forged my own will. In short, there is scarcely a crime that I have not committed.
So says a young lady in one of Jane Austen's shocking adolescent works. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. British novelist Jane Austen, who lived from 1775 to 1817, was the author of classic novels of manners and morals such as Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, Emma, and Persuasion. Some have seen her as prim and proper, yet a look at her teenage writings, or juvenilia, reveals a very different Jane Austen, one who rebelled against conventions of her time. We'll meet heroines who get drunk, raise armies, and throw their rivals out of windows. Joining me to discuss Jane Austen as Monty Python, Austen's girlhood writings, is Joseph Wiesenfarth, Austen scholar and professor emeritus of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you for inviting me, Emily. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I know you're going to be teaching a course in the fall on the campus, a continuing education course, and we'll put a link to that, but calling the course Jane Austen as Monty Python. Tell me about that title. You don't think of Monty Python and Jane Austen usually in the same sentence.
Well, what I'm thinking about in using that title is that if you see somebody being hit in the head with a fish and being knocked into the water, or somebody going into a cheese shop and finding that there's no cheese that can be bought, you're in a world of people acting in a bizarre fashion. And when we read these stories that Jane Austen wrote between age 11 and age 17, she has the same kind of bizarre sense of life that she presents here. And it's one that is not very well known. If you have seen the movie or if you have read the book, the Jane Austen Book Club, you know that the people only talk about the novels, the 6 novels that Jane Austen is known for. And then they try in some way to fit their lives into what's happening in those novels. Now, if they fit their lives into anything that happened in these early writings, they would be murderers, liars, perjurers,
drunks,
insulting people left and right, and so on. So that's why I came up with that rather bizarre sense that if we were thinking of something like Monty Python in Jane Austen's time, we would think of these stories that she wrote as a girl.
And why do you think it is that she wrote them? I mean, who was she writing for?
Well, I think that she wrote them principally for her family. And many of the stories are dedicated to her brothers, and she had 5 brothers. And some of them are dedicated to her sister Cassandra, and to her father and to her mother, and they were her principal audience. And John Spence, in his book on Jane Austen, which is Becoming Jane Austen, says that one of the things that we can credit her family with is giving her a very good sense of not only what was right and wrong, but of what was sensible and what was funny and the sort of thing that would amuse people. And she also wrote some pieces for her brothers when they were at Oxford, editing a journal called The Loiterer. So altogether, I think, for her family and for her friends, these things were written, and for her own amusement, because she could see how ridiculous some of the fiction that she was reading and other people were reading in her time was. And consequently, we get in these stories takeoffs, satires of many of the things that were part of 18th century fiction.
Well, let's hear one of the dedications to an early story that Jane Austen wrote, a story called The Beautiful Cassandra, dedicated to her sister. Let's start with the dedication, and then we'll talk about the tale itself.
The Beautiful Cassandra, a novel in 12 chapters, dedicated by permission to Miss Austen. Dedication. Madam, you are a phoenix. Your taste is refined, your sentiments are noble, and your virtues innumerable. Your person is lovely, your figure elegant, and your form majestic. Your manners are polished, your conversation is rational, and your appearance singular. If, therefore, the following tale will afford one moment's amusement to you, every wish will be gratified of your most obedient, humble servant, the author.
Well, young Jane Austen had a good vocabulary. That's
yes,
clear.
Indeed. Perfectly clear.
And, you know, on the surface, that sounds all very refined and proper.
Yes.
What is she doing there in the dedication? What do you notice about it?
Well, she's very much following the kind of rules and regulations, so to speak, that were set out for the way that women should act. For instance, there is a very famous book by a Dr. Gregory called A Father's Legacy to His Daughters. And in that book, he writes this: "One of the chief beauties in a female character is that modest reserve and retiring delicacy which avoids all public eye. And when a girl ceases to blush, she has lost the most powerful charm of beauty. That extreme sensibility which it indicates may be a witness and an encumbrance in our sex, as I have too often felt, but in yours it is particularly engaging. This modesty, which I think is so essential in your sex, will naturally dispose you to be rather silent in company. Wit, I must say, is the most dangerous talent you can possess. Wit is so flattering to vanity that they who possess it become intoxicated and lose self-command." And he goes on and on with this sort of thing. But if there's anything in these stories, it's somebody who is not being modest and somebody who is being very witty. So the stories are really something of an attack on these guidebooks for women, which were mostly written so that women would act in such a way that they could get husbands. That's what it's all about.
So instead of giving us in The Beautiful Cassandra a heroine who's going to be modest and delicate and silent and so on, what do we get?
Well, somebody who begins by stealing a bonnet out of her mother's shop and then goes and takes a hackney coach on a ride to Hampstead, which in Jane Austen's day anyway was the place to go if you wanted to see the whole of the cityscape of London. She takes the coach there, and then once she arrives there, she never gets out, and she just turns back and goes back to the city. And when she goes back to the city, she meets a number of people on the street whom she is unable to speak to. And we mustn't forget that she goes into a store and eats 6 ices and walks out without paying for them, and then goes back to the coachman, and she's unable to pay him. So she plops the bonnet on his head and then goes home to see her mother, who has forgot all about her daughter taking the bonnet.
Okay, now let's hear that a little bit in Jane Austen's words.
"When Cassandra had attained her 16th year, she was lovely and amiable, and chancing to fall in love with an elegant bonnet, she placed it on her gentle head and walked from her mother's shop to make her fortune. She proceeded to a pastry cook's, where she devoured 6 ices, refused to pay for them, knocked down the pastry cook, and walked away. She next descended a hackney coach and ordered it to Hampstead, where she was no sooner arrived than she ordered the coachman to turn round and drive her back again. Being returned to the same spot of the same street, the coachman demanded his pay. She searched her pockets over again and again, but every search was unsuccessful. No money could she find. The man grew peremptory. She placed her bonnet on his head and ran away. Cassandra smiled and whispered to herself, 'This is a day well spent.'"
Well, and this is a novel in 12 chapters.
This is a novel in 12 chapters in what, 3 or 4 pages?
Yes.
That's right.
But you see young Jane Austen playing with the idea of being an author, calling herself
yes.
that. In this yes. case, you see her just sort of amusing her sister by making her a character who
right.
does some bad things.
Yes, that's right. And not only does she do bad things, but she completely contradicts what Jane Austen had put in the dedication, which, as I said before, models these conduct books like Dr. Gregory's, but the actions of a young girl like Cassandra in this story, who is 16 years old at the time, is the actions are totally bizarre and totally against everything that would be expected of a young woman, especially a young woman who would be expected to be looking for a husband.
So even though the dedication said your taste is refined, your sentiments are noble, you know, your manners are polished, we've instead seen Cassandra knocking over a cook and stealing and behaving
and
in a
the only thing that she comes out is as the phoenix, which is the last sentence of the dedication, because she's alive and well, having gone through all of these mad actions.
And congratulates herself for a day.
And congratulates herself on having done very well. Yes.
Well, we open the program with a little excerpt from a letter from a young lady where instead of just taking, you know, eating some ice, there's murders going on.
Well, that work, practically speaking, speaks for itself. It's part of Jane Austen's playing with the idea of a novel in letters. And in these novels in letters, people do make kinds of confessions. Usually they are the kinds of confessions that are hardly embarrassing. And here you have a woman stepping up and saying, hey, I murdered my father, I murdered my mother, I'm going to murder my sister, but I need a little bit of time to perjure myself first so that I can marry the man for whom I am perjuring myself so that he can come into his inheritance. Now, all of these things, of course, are, in Jane Austen's day, capital crimes. And what she should be doing is going to jail rather than writing these things down on paper, which amount to being a confession. And Jane Austen is saying, well, here's somebody who doesn't exactly follow what Dr. Gregory thinks a young woman should do.
More than not exactly. It's an egregious kind. It's almost as if she's taking every possible offense and throwing it in Dr. Gregory's face. And
right.
Saying, don't tell a young lady what to do.
And there are other murderers who appear in these stories. And in the story Jack and Alice, for instance, the character whose name is Suki and who is jealous of everybody first does her best to stab the woman who is her rival or the young woman who is her rival. And when she fails to do that, she manages to poison her. And Suki then, we are told, perhaps to the satisfaction of all those people who have a strong moral conscience, is raised to the gallows.
Well, if we look at some of these, what seems to be just outrageous behavior, maybe we could take a look at that letter from a young lady and try to figure out if there are subtle versions of that, of some of the offenses like the mercenary marriage or the lack of religion or some of the other things, subtler things that she'll explore later. Let's listen to the letter from a young lady.
A letter from a young lady, whose feelings being too strong for her judgment led her into the commission of errors which her heart disapproved. Many have been the cares and vicissitudes of my past life, my beloved Eleanor, and the only consolation I feel for their bitterness is that on a close examination of my conduct, I am convinced that I strictly deserve them. I murdered my father at a very early period of my life, I have since murdered my mother, and I am now going to murder my sister. I have changed my religion so often that at present I have not an idea of any left. I have been a perjured witness in every public trial for these past 12 years, and I have forged my own will. In short, there is scarcely a crime that I have not committed. But I am now going to reform. Colonel Martin of the Horse Guards has paid his addresses to me, and we are to be married in a few days. As there is something singular in our courtship, I will give you an account of it. Colonel Martin is the second son of the last Sir John Martin, who died immensely rich, but bequeathing only £100,000 apiece to his 3 younger children, left the bulk of his fortune, about 8 million, to the present Sir Thomas. Upon his small pittance, the colonel lived tolerably contented for nearly 4 months, when he took it into his head to determine on getting the whole of his eldest brother's estate. A new will was forged, and the colonel produced it in court. But nobody would swear to its being the right will except himself, and he had sworn so much that nobody believed him. At that moment I happened to be passing by the door of the court, and was beckoned in by the judge, who told the colonel that I was a lady ready to witness anything for the cause of justice, and advised him to apply to me. In short, the affair was soon adjusted. The colonel and I swore to its being the right will, and Sir Thomas has been obliged to resign all his ill-gotten wealth. The colonel, in gratitude, waited on me the next day with an offer of his hand. I am now going to murder my sister. Yours ever, Anna Parker.
That ending, after she said she was going to reform, and then she says, and I'm now going to murder my sister, yours ever.
Yes. What's another one, you know, after so many? You know, instead of reading like a Jane Austen novel, it reads like an Elmore Leonard story in which people are killed just because that's the way that one writes crime novels. But here this is supposed to be an elegant young lady who is carrying on in a different way. But the way that she's carrying on is like an Elmore Leonard criminal.
Well, and if we're trying to figure out what Jane Austen is doing here, this young girl writing something like this, you said she's mocking in part the sentimental novels and letters, you know, by saying, my beloved Eleanor. This is in the form of a letter.
Yes.
And yours truly and all the rest of it. So she's making fun of that. She's rejecting the notion of the ladylike behavior and turning that upside down. But when she gets to this part about marrying a man for his fortune, it's getting a little bit more social in commentary, isn't it?
Right. Well, so much that goes on in these stories is about this kind of thing. For instance, in the story The Three Sisters, of the three sisters, Mary is the eldest. And it's in her mind that she must marry before either of her other two sisters do. The thing is that she is the least attractive and the most abrasive, but she gets the attention of a rich man whose name is Mr. Watts. And she decides that she will marry Mr. Watts after going back and forth, should I or shouldn't I? And he doesn't care whether she's going to marry him or not. He said, I'd just be satisfied with any one of the three of you. And all that he wants is a warm body in his bed, and he doesn't care whether she likes him or not. And she makes the point to the Duttons, with whom she is with at this time, to say that as far as marriage goes, it's not important that people love each other. It's only important that one person love the other.
So one-way partnership.
Yes, a one-way partnership. So that what we have here is the kind of thing happening very rapidly that we see happening over a period of chapters in Pride and Prejudice, where Mr. Collins comes to marry the eldest of the Bennet sisters, Jane, finds that Jane may be already engaged, at least in Mrs. Bennet's mind, to Mr. Bingley. So he said, okay, I'll switch to Elizabeth. And Elizabeth is very bright, whereas Mr. Collins is very dumb, and she doesn't want to have anything to do with him and turns him down. So he decides that he will marry her friend Charlotte Lucas. And again, it's a case of somebody who doesn't care what woman he has as long as he has one in bed.
And they're just interchangeable sort of
interchangeable
pieces of property. So let's hear a little bit of Mary Stanhope in The Three Sisters.
I am the happiest creature in the world, for I've received an offer of marriage from Mr. Watts. How I will triumph over the Duttons. He is quite an old man, about 32, very plain, so plain that I cannot bear to look at him. He is extremely disagreeable, and I hate him more than anybody else in the world. He has a large fortune and will make great settlements on me. But then he is very healthy. In short, I do not know what to do. If I accept him, I know I shall be miserable all the rest of my life, for he is very ill-tempered and peevish. But I believe I shall have him. It will be such a triumph to be married before Sophie, Georgiana, and the Duttons.
That part about how, you know, he's got a large fortune, but he's healthy.
he's
not going to die and
he's
leave me.
He's not
going
to die, no. He's going to make me stay married to him much too long.
And, you know, we find that today with the sort of gold-digging marriages where some young playboy bunny marries a, you know, older person and hopes they die. Then in terms of Mary Stanhope, once she's trying to figure out whether to marry this disagreeable person, she puts forward demands that have to happen.
Yes, all sorts of demands.
Remember, I am to have a new carriage hung as high as the Duttons, and blue spotted with silver. And I shall expect a new saddle horse, a suit of fine lace, and an infinite number of the most valuable jewels. Diamonds such as never were seen, and pearls, rubies, emeralds, and beads out of number. You must set up your phaeton, which must be cream-colored with a wreath of silver flowers round it. You must buy 4 of the finest bays in the kingdom, and you must drive me in it every day. This is not all. You must entirely new furnish your house after my taste. You must hire 2 more footmen to attend me, 2 women to wait on me, must always let me do just as I please and make a very good husband.
And pray, Miss Stanhope, what am I to expect from you in return for all of this?
Expect? Why, you may expect to have me pleased.
There you go.
We're going to look more at the teenage writings of Jane Austen when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UW Extension Division of Continuing Education, Outreach, and E-Learning, helping working professionals meet their continuing education and professional development goals. 1-866-505-UWIN.
To Miss Cooper, cousin. Conscious of the charming character which in every country and every clime in Christendom is cried concerning you with caution and care, I commend to your charitable criticism this clever collection of curious comments, which have been carefully culled, collected, and classed by your comical cousin, the author.
That's a dedication to a collection of letters, a work by Jane Austen as a teenager. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. My guest is Joseph Wiesenfarth, and we are talking about Jane Austen as Monty Python, her girlhood writings, these irreverent, lively, shocking works. We've seen her describing murders and marriages based on money and all kinds of unladylike behavior. In something like that, with that dedication to Miss Cooper, we see her, it seems to me, just having fun with language.
Yes, we've talked about actions in the stories and the way those actions go against everything that is prescribed for the way that young women should behave themselves. And that's a lot of fun when we read them. But there's also the way that Jane Austen writes these things. And in that particular passage, you have a whole series of phrases that all begin with the letter C. And Jane Austen likes very much to repeat things, especially when they make things ludicrous. And there is that wonderful passage that comes from Leslie Castle, where the letter M is more prominent than anything else.
Though retired from almost all the world, for we visit no one but the McLeods, the Mackenzies, the McPhersons, the McCartneys, the McDonalds, the McKinnons, the McClellans, the McKays, the Macbeths, and the Macduffs, we are neither dull nor unhappy. On the contrary, there never were 2 more lively, more agreeable, or more witty girls than we are. Not an hour in the day hangs heavy on our hands. We read, we work, we walk, and when fatigued with these employments, relieve our spirits either by a lively song, a grateful dance, or by some smart bon mot and witty repartee. We are handsome, my dear Charlotte, very handsome, and the greatest of our perfections is that we are entirely insensible of them ourselves.
Such modesty.
Well, it's a perfect... There's actually a couple examples in there of Austen's use of irony that she's so famous for because, you know, she said, we visit no one but... And then this whole list of people.
Yes.
And then this thing where they're not conscious of their own virtues, but they're saying it, so they're contradicting it. Why does Jane Austen like that so much, do you think?
Well, I think she likes it for the very reason that you are mentioning it, because it catches our attention and it makes us laugh.
And what does it expose about human nature? Because it seems to me there is something going on here that is wise beyond her years, that she sees through illusions in some way.
Right. There are too many people who are of the Dr. Gregory mold here who are not very smart at all the way that they are supposed to be in order to get married. And certainly this is an example of one of them. And we've already seen that in the case of Mary and Mr. Watts. And any number of other stories have people who are just unable to think clearly or with any amount of logic. And I think one of the best examples that we get of that is in Jack and Alice, where Lady Williams, who is supposedly the wise and mature woman, on a number of occasions gives advice to the young Lucy, who is 17 years old. And the advice that she gives always is contradictory. And there is that passage, to take just one of them, in which Lucy is now in Bath and she has met the Duke of Dash, because no particular place is mentioned. And in that, Lucy is saying, he has made a proposal of marriage to me. He's really very, very rich, and he's not very healthy, unlike Mr. Watts.
Which is a good thing.
Looks like he's going to pop off soon. What do you think I should do? And Lady Williams comes back with this remarkable bit of contradictory advice.
Why do you hesitate, my dearest Lucy, a moment with respect to the Duke? I have inquired into his character and find him an unprincipled, illiterate man. Never shall my Lucy be united to such a one. He has a princely fortune, which is every day increasing. How nobly will you spend it? What credit will you give him in the eyes of all? How much will he be respected on his wife's account? But why, my dearest Lucy, why will you not at once decide this affair by returning to me and never leaving me again?
So he's unprincipled and illiterate, but he's wealthy, so how will you spend the money?
Yes, that's right. And when we get to a situation where prior to this, the question is, will Lucy go to Bath or will she stay with Lady Williams? Lady Williams is saying, oh, you must go to Bath and make your fortune there. Find a person who will marry you and make your fortune. But if you leave me, I will perish with sorrow and I will just die. But if you stay with me, I'll go bankrupt and I won't be able to keep you. And you constantly get this kind of craziness that one gets used to, I think, in these stories.
And I suppose that looks forward a bit to the novels where some of the parents seem to be like the children and incapable of giving good guidance.
Advice. Yes. Yeah.
Well, you know, that quote was from Jack and Alice, a story which is kind of remarkable because Jack and Alice, even though they're in the title, are not really the central characters in the book.
Yes, and there's that point in the story where Jane Austen says, oh, I haven't mentioned Jack in this story.
Right.
The reason I haven't mentioned Jack in this story is that he was a drunk and he died of drinking too much. Therefore, I can only talk about Alice.
It may now be proper to return to the hero of this novel, the brother of Alice, of whom I believe I have scarcely had occasion to speak, which may perhaps be partly owing to his unfortunate propensity to liquor, which so completely deprived him of the use of those faculties nature had endowed him with that he never did anything worth mentioning. His death was the natural consequence of this pernicious practice. By his decease, his sister became the sole inheritress of a very large fortune, which, as it gave her fresh hopes of rendering herself acceptable as a wife to Charles Adams, could not fail of being most pleasing to her. And as the effect was joyful, the cause could scarcely be lamented.
She's kind of making fun of the sort of narrator voice in a lot of earlier novels. What, would it be Fielding? Or who she kind of, you know, oh, I forgot to mention the hero. There's this voice that comes in and kind of provides commentary.
Yeah, I suppose that Fielding would be as good a person as any to think about in this situation. I'm wondering when she writes about Henry and Eliza is a foundling, whether we're not back in Tom Jones, except that Tom Jones is 800 pages and Henry and Eliza is about 8.
Right. Well, and how shocking would it have been for Jane Austen to be writing about drunks? I mean, she talks about the hero of the novel who's drunk. She also tells us the heroine, Alice, you know, says she has many rare and charming qualities, but sobriety is not one of them. The whole family is a sad, drunken set.
That's right, yes.
That would have been pretty shocking for Austen's time, wouldn't it?
Well, I guess it would be in itself and outside the story to be something shocking and something that one would not be, generally speaking, talking about. But in the story, of course, it makes perfect sense. And again, with Lady Williams, we get the kind of repetition that we were talking about before, where she constantly refers to the red face that Alice has because she's been drinking too much and says that, well, somebody with a red face is not really beautiful. And Alice's reply is always, I can't think of anything more beautiful than a red face. So that constantly you get this kind of repetition and you get this craziness that comes from the one taking the one position, the other taking the other position. Then three times they almost come to hitting each other when something else comes along and distracts them, so they get on to something else.
One thing that amuses me about these stories, I guess, is the way Austin will use language as if it's out of, I don't know, Dr. Johnson or something very proper and formal. Yes. And, you know, carefully constructed sentences. She's saying these absolutely outrageous things or absurd, ridiculous things, but doing so in a sort of beautifully elegant way. Let's listen to the description of Charles Adams that comes in Jack and Alice, and then also to what Charles has to say, but first with this description that she gives us.
Charles Adams was an amiable, accomplished, and bewitching young man, of so dazzling a beauty that none but eagles could look him in the face. Miss Simpson was pleasing in her person, in her manners, and in her disposition. An unbounded ambition was her only fault. Her second sister, Suki, was envious, spiteful, and malicious. Her person was short, fat, and disagreeable. In Lady Williams, every virtue met. She was a widow with a handsome jointure and the remains of a handsome face. Though benevolent and candid, she was generous and sincere. Though pious and good, she was religious and amiable. And though elegant and agreeable, she was polished and entertaining. The Johnsons were a family of love, and though a little addicted to the bottle and the dice, had many good qualities.
So what do you notice there?
What I notice is very obvious is the contradictions that one sees in this description of these people. You know, what Jane Austen is giving us here is her version of humor characters. Characters who are absolutely controlled by one thing. So each one of these three sisters has some one thing that controls her actions. And the way that those actions are controlled leads to the kinds of marriages that they make before the story ends. But then we get the situation of Charles Adams, and when the story opens, it opens with a masquerade. And in the masquerade, Charles Adams appears as the sun, and he is so bright that people have to stand a half mile away in this three-quarter mile long room so that they are not too blinded by Charles Adams. And then when everybody else takes off his and her mask, they find out that Charles Adams hasn't got a mask on at all, that he indeed is the sun.
You know, when she writes about Charles being amiable, accomplished, and bewitching with dazzling beauty, it sounds almost as if she's reversing gender roles. You would expect the woman to be described that way, right?
I think that there is some of that that's going on, but certainly it's clear when Charles has Mr. Johnson visit him in order to make a proposal that he marry Alice, and then Charles, the very manly Charles, the person whose command of language is almost the command of a Samuel Johnson, gives an answer to that proposal, which is, "Sir, I may perhaps be expected to appear pleased at and grateful for the offer that you have made to me, but let me tell you that I consider it as an affront. I look upon myself to be, sir, a perfect beauty. Where would you see a finer figure or a more charming face? Then, sir, I imagine my manners and address to be of the most polished kind. There is a certain elegance, a peculiar sweetness in them that I never saw equaled and cannot describe. Partiality aside, I am certainly more accomplished in every language, every science, every art, and everything than any other person in Europe. My temper is even, my virtues innumerable, myself unparalleled. Since such, sir, is my character, what do you mean by wishing me to marry your daughter? Let me give you a short sketch of yourself and of her. I look upon you, sir, to be a very good sort of man in the main. A drunken old dog, to be sure, but that's nothing to me. Your daughter, sir, is neither sufficiently beautiful, sufficiently amiable, sufficiently witty, nor sufficiently rich for me. I expect nothing more in my wife than my wife will find in me. Perfection. These are my sentiments, and I honor myself for having such.
That's funny. And he's so vain.
Yes.
But we've seen her putting that sort of thought in the mouth of a young woman as well.
That's right. And he talks about himself as being beautiful,
yes.
You know, and charming, and so on, and having a good figure.
Yes. And so, he honors himself for feeling that way.
And he honors himself for feeling that way. Yes. It's the irony in this particular story, Jack and Alice, is that at the very end, and in the very last sentence, we find out that Charles Adams has married. And who has he married? He has married Lady Williams, the silliest, stupidest, least beautiful of the women in the whole story.
But she's the one with the handsome jointure in the remains of it. Now, a jointure would be a settlement on her, so
right,
she's got the money.
Right. So perhaps the shoe is on the other foot here, where he's hoping she won't last too long.
And the picture of Charles Adams reminds me a little bit of Sir Walter Elliot in Persuasion.
Oh,
this very vain booby, really.
Oh, I mean, yes, absolutely.
Looking at himself in mirrors all the time.
That's right. And in the movie, if you saw the movie Persuasion, there's that wonderful moment where they're sitting at table and he takes up a rather large table knife, which is highly polished, and he looks at himself in the table knife, which is like looking at himself in the mirror, which is just, he can't concentrate on his food. He has to concentrate on himself.
It seems Jane Austen must have really disliked vanity and hypocrisy. And what else did she dislike, do you think?
I don't know, but she must have met an awful lot of people who were just awful.
And didn't know they were awful either.
The people didn't. She did.
No, she did, but they were.
That's right.
They thought they were perfect.
That's right, yes.
She also seems to be attacking the notion of marriage for the sake of show. You know,
yes.
People who go, you know, are more interested
yes.
in the wedding almost than in the marriage.
Right.
Can you say something about the odd part in Leslie Castle, where the woman seems to be concerned not about the health of the bridegroom, but about the food?
That's right. It's Charlotte who has prepared the wedding banquet for her sister and the husband-to-be. And she's taking a great deal of time to do this. And what has happened is that the fiancé on his way to the wedding is the victim of an accident, falling off his horse. And if he's not quite dead yet, he's going to be dead soon. And the thing that really upsets her, that is Charlotte, is not that she's not going to have a brother-in-law, but that she's not going to have a brother-in-law to eat all of these things that she has prepared for them for the wedding.
What provokes me more than anything else is that the matches broke off and all my labor thrown away. Imagine how great the disappointment must be to me when you consider that after having labored both by night and by day in order to get the wedding dinner ready by the time appointed, after having roasted beef, broiled mutton, and stewed soup enough to last the newly married couple through the honeymoon, I had the mortification of finding that I had been roasting, broiling, and stewing both the meat and myself to no purpose. Indeed, my dear friend, I never remember suffering any vexation equal to what I experienced on last Monday when my sister came running to me in the storeroom with her face as white as a whipped syllabub and told me that Hervey had been thrown from his horse, had fractured his skull, and was pronounced by his surgeon to be in the most imminent danger. "Good God," said I, "you don't say so. Why, what in the name of heaven will become of all the victuals? We shall never be able to eat it while it is good. However, we'll call in the surgeon to help us. I shall be able to manage the sirloin myself. My mother will eat the soup, and you and the doctor must finish the rest. Here I was interrupted by seeing my poor sister fall down to appearance lifeless upon one of the chests where we keep our table linen.
There's a lot of eating going on in these stories, too, which I suppose would have been considered unladylike.
Well, I suppose that everybody has to eat.
Right, but they eat an awful lot.
They do eat an awful lot. And in Henry and Eliza, I don't know if you remember when Eliza is imprisoned by the Duchess of F and manages to find a rope and a hacksaw in her cell. She saws her way through the bars and then gets out of prison, but she has her two children with her. And she throws her clothes down on the ground first, and then she throws the children on top of the clothes. And as she's throwing them, saying, "Be careful you don't hurt yourself." But insofar as they're escaping from prison and they have no money and no nourishment and so on, we're told that her children eat off two of her fingers.
More on the juvenile works of Jane Austen when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Having therefore, agreeable to that in the natural turn of her mind to make everyone happy, promised to become his wife the next morning, he took his leave, and the two ladies sat down to supper on a young leveret, a brace of partridges, a leash of pheasants, and a dozen of pigeons. It was not till the next morning that Charlotte recollected the double engagement she had entered into, but when she did, the reflection of her past folly operated so strongly in her mind that she resolved to be guilty of a greater, and to that end threw herself into a deep stream which ran through her aunt's pleasure grounds in Portland Place. She floated to Crankham Dunbury, where she was picked up and buried. The following epitaph, composed by Frederick, Elfrida, and Rebecca, was placed on her tomb. Epitaph. Here lies our friend, who having promised that unto two she would be married, threw her sweet body and her lovely face into the stream that runs through Portland Place. These sweet lines, as pathetic as beautiful, were never read by anyone who passed that way without a shower of tears, which, if they should fail of exciting in you, reader, your mind must be unworthy to peruse them.
That's an excerpt from Frederick and Elfrida, a story written by Jane Austen when she was about 11 or 12 years old. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. My guest is Joseph Wiesenfarth, and we're talking about Jane Austen as Monty Python. What do you hear in that passage with the sentimental epitaph and the Charlotte committing suicide after discovering... Oh,
the first thing I hear is a reconfiguration of geography. I didn't know that there was a stream that ran through Portland Place. But aside from that, of course, we have her doing all of this eating, and we've seen something about eating before. And I came across this passage in Northrop Frye's book called A Double Vision, and I think it might apply to some of the things that are going on in Jane Austen. Frye writes this way, "Human beings are concerned beings, and it seems to me that there are two kinds of concern, primary and secondary. Primary concerns are such things as food, sex, property, and freedom of movement, concerns that we share with the animals on a physical level. Secondary concerns include our political, religious, and other ideological loyalties. All through history, ideological concerns have taken precedence over primary ones. We want to live and love, but we go to war. We want freedom, but depend on the exploiting of other peoples, of the natural environment, even of ourselves." Now, I thought that passage was interesting because what we have been talking about are food, certainly in terms of marriage, sex, in terms of what you get when you're married, property, and even in a story like Henry and Eliza, freedom of movement, because Eliza is imprisoned. And although this is very serious and a very thoughtful and philosophical reflection on the way that human lives are organized, what we find, I think, in Jane Austen is As a girl, she has a sense of the importance of things like food and sex and freedom of movement. And these are things that she gives us in her stories. And, of course, she gives us them in an outrageous fashion because, in a sense, people realize how important they are, so they'll do anything to have them.
And are you suggesting with that passage from Northrop Frye then that even though we might be reading about something that seems kind of on a petty, silly level, that some of the human failings, the selfishness, the greed, the lust, are behind larger movements, war and, you know, all kinds of things in the adult world, and Jane Austen is sort of aware of that.
Right. And we haven't talked about the history of England, but if we think about the history of England, this is Jane Austen's story that she wrote or history that she wrote when she was 15, although she said it's a history without any dates and that she has to be forgiven if, as a historian, she sometimes tells the truth. What we see in that is that the ideology of the kings and the queens of England have led them just to kill people off whenever they wanted because it doesn't fit what they want things to be, so that all of these things that are important are denied to people because they don't fit the ideology of a particular ruler.
It seems to me Jane Austen is sounding very revolutionary in these sketches. Is that why you think the relatives suppressed these stories, didn't want them published after her early death at 40?
Well, given the code of manners of the time, I think they didn't want to have it known that somebody in their family was not quite as proper as she should have been. Although we have to remember that these stories exist in three volumes and that her father bought her these books in order to transcribe these stories. What we have are not the stories as they were written initially. They are the stories as Jane Austen wrote them in a book and corrected them to suit herself as she matured.
One of the things we can't see on radio is all the spelling mistakes, which
That's
are
right.
part of the charm because they
right.
remind us as we read that this is a right. young girl writing.
Right. And I've edited two of these stories and from manuscript. And so there are lots of corrections that are made, things that are crossed out and things that are written over and so on. So.
One of the most famous stories from her juvenile works is called Love and Friendship, with friendship misspelled
yes.
in the title. But Love and Friendship, can you tell us about that story?
Well, it's a remarkable story for somebody who was 14 years old. And if I may, I would just like to say about it what was said by Juliet McMaster. Love and Friendship is arguably the funniest short work of fiction in the English language. Jane Austen supplies not only one surpassingly handsome and sensitive hero, but a brace of them. Not one long-lost grandchild, but four, all separately discovered in the course of as many minutes. Not just three or four families in a country village, but a set of irresponsibly marauding young poseurs who traverse England, Wales, and Scotland, who racket from London to Gretna Green, gracefully purloining banknotes, promoting elopements, and scattering mayhem on their way. And the interesting thing is that when these stories were first published in 1922, which is the year before the Chapman edition of the Oxford Jane Austen came out.
And over 100 years after her death.
Right. The title of the volume was Love and Friendship. So it was the story that G.K. Chesterton and Virginia Woolf most admired for the genius of its humor. What we have in Love and Friendship is a novel which is, in a sense, a conduct book. But it's a conduct book in which the person who is the principal character does everything wrong. And what you have is a young girl named Marianne whose mother asks Laura, who is the principal character in the story, whether she will write to Marianne and tell her about all of the things that she did so that Marianne will know exactly what not to do if she is going to succeed in life. So this is a conduct book in reverse. Don't do this, whatever you do.
And one of my favorite parts of this story, maybe we'll hear a little bit of this, is when the two young women who are instant friends run into a disaster in the road.
two gentlemen most elegantly attired but weltering in their blood was what first struck our eyes. We approached. They were Edward and Augustus. Yes, dearest Marianne, they were our husbands. Sophia shrieked and fainted on the ground. I screamed and instantly ran mad. We remained thus mutually deprived of our senses some minutes, and on regaining them were deprived of them again. For an hour and a quarter did we continue in this unfortunate situation, Sophia fainting every moment, and I running mad as often. At length a groan from the hapless Edward, who alone retained any share of life, restored us to ourselves. Had we indeed before imagined that either of them lived, we should have been more sparing of our grief. But as we had supposed when we first beheld them that they were no more, we knew that nothing could remain to be done but what we were about. No sooner, therefore, did we hear my Edward's groan than, postponing our lamentations for the present, we hastily ran to the dear youth and, kneeling on each side of him, implored him not to die.
So there it's more important for them to swoon and to scream and to fall into each other's arms than it is to find out whether these two people, whom they love, their husbands, are dead.
Yeah, they don't exactly do CPR, do they?
No, there's no CPR.
Do you think this is Jane Austen saying, look, if you make women helpless, delicate, fainting creatures, they're not going to save your life?
There's that. And also, if you think that sentimental novels are the things that will get you through life, think again. They will get you to death more quickly.
So what is the moral, then, of love and friendship? What is the, you know, you said this is an anti-conduct book. This is a sort of conduct book in reverse telling you this is what not to do.
Yeah, well, what we have here is a picaresque novel in which these picaros, these women and their husbands, are doing all of the wrong things. And all of the wrong things are exactly the things that Marianne should avoid if she's going to succeed in life. So the moral of the story is be yourself, don't be them.
And beware of swoons, as she says.
And beware of swooning, right.
Well, final thoughts on these juvenilia, then. I mean, are these just sort of ridiculous teenage works that we read because Jane Austen is a famous novelist, so we read everything she wrote, or do they have merit in and of themselves?
Well, I read these because they're funny. They're enjoyable. Some people want to read these stories to find those things in them that will make their way in a different way into the novels. But that's not the only way to read these. And one way to read them is simply to sit down and read this book because you enjoy it.
And we'll put a link to information about the class you'll be doing in the fall on Jane Austen as Monty Python, Jane Austen's Girlhood Writings, on our University of the Year website. I'd like to thank Joe Wiesenforth for being my guest and Melanie Meyer for being our young Jane Austen reader. I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join Norman Gilliland and me for the next hour of University of the Year.
Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, he was the first European to enter what is now known as Wisconsin. But why did Jean Nicolet come here? And was he really wearing a Chinese robe when he did? For the answers, join us next Sunday here on Wisconsin Public Radio.